Thanks for tuning into this brand new series on Michelanius called Stranger Conversations. I will be joined by Jared Williams as we discuss different ideas, including our own theoretical analysis and thoughts on the Netflix series Stranger Things. This episode is part one of a 12-part series where Jared and I discuss season one, episodes 1 through 4. Forewarning that there may be explicit conversation or content discussed that may be uncomfortable for some viewers. Viewer discretion is advised. With that being said, here's episode one of Stranger Conversations. Obviously, we're 6 years ahead of when it first came out. I guess for me, it was in season four, and it was when I started just kind of thinking about, but it was a certain scene where I was trying to understand exactly, because sometimes in shows, there is a little bit of symbolism that exists that, you know, just to kind of articulate and to put into picture some sort of mental understanding or something of, or how to perceive something in some sort of way. And so it's because of a scene in four where I started thinking, well, maybe this is doing this in all these other seasons. That's why I kind of wanted to go back to the very beginning and start watching the episodes and really psychoanalyzing like the shit out of it. You are going to be so probably annoyed by all of the symbolism and everything that I want to talk about.
Well, I want to say, first off, the thing that sucked me into the show was just the 80s vibe right off the bat. I've always been fascinated about that type of stuff. That's the reason that I even started watching it to begin with. But yeah, it did kind of blow my mind when I started watching it that the first season came out all the way back in 2016. I think when I first started watching it was, I would say, a year ago. It wasn't very long ago. And then I just kind of binged the whole thing. I think it's kind of natural for people that watch this show to try to find trends like what you've been doing. Because the show between season one and now the end of season four has strayed so far off. And I'm not saying that in a bad way. I'm just saying a lot of things have happened. Like feels like an entirely different storyline. So I think it's pretty normal to try to analyze some things, like some symbolism that underlies the storyline to try to make sense of it. I'm more of a recent viewer. I mean, when did you start watching it?
I want to say it was around when season two came out, I think. I think I'm the same as you. I just really like the 80s vibes. I was watching a YouTube video and it was like the costume designer. She was talking about all of these different characters and how she wanted to, everything was obviously, she wanted to keep it all 80s and everything. And in the fourth season, the character Eddie, the really long hair, the one who's accused, spoiler alert for.
Oh yeah.
Doesn't watch it yet. There might be spoiler alerts. He's a guy who had the really long kind of like permish hair for his jacket because he's like big into Aerosmith, all these like Megadeth or something like that. I don't know all the different band names, but the lady, she's like talking about not even just like having to make one of the outfits, but she has to make so many just in case it's like being used for stunts. And by stunts, it could be as simple as like even like they throw a liquid on somebody and they might not have liked how it landed on that. So they have to try it again and they throw the liquid again and. So they made so many of them, but like they kept so much of it accurate to the times and, or they would think about like with Eleven, well, Eleven, she's getting a lot of like hand-me-down type stuff, but she still wants to look girly. So basically she might be wearing like Mike's old shirts, but then she'll be wearing some sort of dress on top of that. So it doesn't look stylistically pleasing to look at, but it's like the circumstance of it. So it's not only just the time of, you know, what it would look like, what the like the actual different outfits would look like, but also situationally how she's doesn't have a home, she didn't have clothes, so she was given clothes, stuff kind of like that, which I thought was kind of interesting.
They did an amazing job. I can't find a hole anywhere in that 1980s vibe. I can't really find a mistake anywhere. Maybe I didn't look close enough or what, but I mean, even down to like the houses that they show, like the houses look like they're from the 60s, 70s, and 80s. So, and like the interior furnishings, you know, I mean, it's pretty impressive. So I would imagine that the directors probably spent a lot of time and effort just on that alone. I mean, that'd be a ton of work.
Yeah. I think there's also something which they could have done it for the 90s too. I do think I like it that it's not modern day. They don't have to find a way and they also can't have phones. So they can't find a way of even utilizing phones. It's how do you like operate within this world without having the technology that everyone is so accustomed to using nowadays. If we're jumping into episode one, frankly, you probably should bring up the thing that you had just found last night. So it's not really anything that's much of a surprise, but if you want to talk about the thing that you saw.
Michael here had gotten some outside information from another source talking about this idea that Will Byers might be gay.
I watched a YouTube video. The guy was talking about this idea, and I was just like, what the hell?
Yeah.
Like, yeah. What are you talking about? He's not. And then, you know, it wasn't probably until watching season four, really, that, you know, you start seeing a lot of this inference. Was not even paying attention to that.
Yeah. Well, and so he said this a few days ago, and then I, since we're, you know, starting chronologically with this series, I figured I should go back and rewatch prior to discussing each episode and season. So I watched the first few episodes, and now I'm realizing, like, having that in the back of my brain while watching these episodes, like, there's actually a lot of hints pointed at that. So I ended up texting Michael and being like, dude, there's hints all over the place. I think it was the first episode, Joyce goes into the sheriff's department to talk to Hopper, and they start talking about how Will is always made fun of because people think he's gay. Hopper asks Joyce, well, is he? And then Joyce just kind of pauses and hesitates and doesn't really know what to say.
She's like, there's no way. It's like, I don't even know why we're talking about it. Like, they're just like making fun of him.
It's like this trend though that you see, you know, like if they're, you know, he's being made fun for it by his classmates, you know, and it's like a problem throughout all these seasons. And then he gets older and it starts to like manifest itself more clearly. It's pretty interesting. It's not stuff that you notice if you're a new watcher and you don't have it in your brain at the time.
No, if you're not thinking about it along those lines, it just seems like it's just, oh, this kid's, you know, oh, he's just a kid that gets called gay sometimes. Wow. No boy ever growing up is ever called that.
Never.
And never was at any point. Maybe not nowadays with, you know, more PC culture, but it was very much a common thing for most guys growing up. Like, your friends call you gay.
Oh, yeah.
Just for, you know, whatever reason that we would do it. Unless you were kind of set on that initial kind of wavelength with it, you would just think it's just 80s government conspiracy that this, you know, aliens. So this was the situation at the police station. The secretary walks up to Jim Hopper, who's like the main adult male character in the show. The secretary's like, Joyce called and said she can't find her son. If we skip forward to Joyce is in Hopper's office. They're talking about the son. And the way that Joyce describes Will's taken at this point. She's describing to Hopper, he's not like you. He's not like me. He's not like most. Has a couple of friends that are mean. They make fun of his clothes, call him names. They laugh at his clothes. He's like, his clothes, what's wrong with his clothes? And then he's like, does that matter? His friends always call him gay and like the queer. I think they actually used queer, said calls him queer. If you want to talk about it, Hopper's just like, well, is he?
And then Joyce just doesn't really know what to say. It kind of leaves that open gap for viewers to fill in for themselves. If you're not looking for it, you just kind of overlook it. And I know I did the first time I watched it.
Could it make it easier because it's the 80s and it's not the 2020s where it's something where it's just either don't talk about it, you don't know what to say even if you did talk about it?
No, that was definitely a thing in the 80s for sure. I can't even remember a specific song called Money for Nothing. Have you ever heard it, Michael, by Dire Straits?
You want to sing it for me?
And no, but I could play it if you wanted me to. But there's a part in that song, after listening to it, I can infer that some of these rising 80s musicians, you know, maybe some of them were wearing earrings, maybe a little bit of makeup and stuff. They were called gay, you know, all the time by other people. And there's a section in this song is really popular. The person singing says, like, this little faggot, he's a millionaire. He's talking about himself. He's like, yeah, you're going to call me this. You're going to call me gay. I'm a millionaire. I think that was a pretty big thing in the 80s. I really do think it was. That's part of the reason I just brushed it off.
Yeah, it was definitely something where you just kind of skip past the conversation. It wasn't like you wanted to dive too much into it. Then we kind of skip forward a little ways. Joyce is at home and Joyce gets a phone call from a random person or thing. And this is the very end of like the episode. There's one more thing that happens after this, but like this is like within 2 or 3 minutes of the episode being done. So she's like yelling, screaming, or whatever. And then she gets shocked somehow and the call ends. If you were to symbolize it, maybe just the phone call was just shocking. Then you see Mike and Lucas, they're talking on their walkie talkies or something about the game that they were playing at the beginning of the episode and how Will made the choice that he made for sacrificing himself for the team because of the decision that he made in the game, which propelled them and Dustin to go out looking for Will. So all of them, all these three boys, they're in the woods. And then all of a sudden, they run into 11. I don't mean to bring it up as though it has to be some sort of... But we understand that Will's gay. If you look at the very beginning, this is something where I started like within the first 17 minutes. is where I found it to be really interesting. So you see the boys are playing, you see that Will is kind of, he's like being panicked, pushed against the wall to make this decision in this game, right? And then immediately when everyone has to leave, because it's late at night, the parents want their kids to go home. Mike and Will are standing outside and they're talking right before Will leaves Mike's house. And you see there's like this weird interaction between the two. And then you see the light flickering on the garage exterior light, and the light's flickering. All of a sudden, the boys are leaving. Then Will finds himself by himself. He speeds ahead of Dustin. Dustin's just winded because he just apparently just can't ride his bike very fast. No idea. Then we see that all of a sudden, Will's lights start to flicker. And you see the creature. And then all of a sudden, it's dark. And then you see at the very end of the episode, or the end of that sequence anyways, where he's in the shed and he has the gun. All of a sudden, the light like flickers for a little way. It goes really bright. And then it like turns off and then turns back on. And it's like really bright in there. And this is where my idea of like light really comes into this series. The first with Mike, if it's not a, hey, pay attention to this sequence, like it's a really interesting situation right here, where it's just the minimal interaction that he's having with Mike. If you were to say that these moments are supposed to be kind of from Will's perspective, where Will's starting to kind of get a vibe of how his feelings are for Mike, like as though light says like it's like constant and it is fluid. And in the fact that it's flinking, it's like unfamiliar territories. The ideas and feelings that he's feeling is why that's happening in that moment. And then it's not until he's going down by himself down the road where his light's flickering and he sees this creature where it might start be settling in for him, the realizations that he's starting to have. This is where kind of later on we start to see maybe where traditional religious and a belief system has led him to believe that the emotions and feelings he's having are bad, or like, you know, demons or devil, you know, and that's why he sees this creature is because it's like, oh God, like I think maybe how I've been feeling has been this. And that's why he's afraid, is because he doesn't want to be, you know, rejected. He doesn't want to be, you know, bullied or fearful or anything like that, right? And so he runs away from it. And then that's why you see at the very end where no matter what, this creature is going after him because it's the realization of his life and that he just, it's starting to just approach him and he's so scared of it because he's just not used to this sort of acceptance of something he shouldn't accept, with the shed at the end where he's finally being confronted and like he just kind of needs to accept and like this demon is like taking a hold of him now. It's not until he's gone and then all of a sudden the light's bright, as though to say when him and this feeling, they're gone, it's just brighter. It's more comfortable. I don't know. Maybe theoretically you could say that people are more comfortable in light, something where it's not so dark and you're able to kind of understand a situation.
Yeah. Just in the first episode alone, you know, you saw like probably three or four specific instances of that light flickering in some sort of circumstance. I mean, like I said, you know, a lot of these things that we're going to talk about as a first-time viewer, you're not even going to notice right off the bat. You're going to notice them, but you're not going to think anything of them. You know how it goes. When trying to watch the first couple episodes of a new series, you're trying to vie for any information you can, trying to make sense of what's going on. And so you're just going to kind of look over that stuff. But yeah, well, even within the first 45 minutes of the show, I'd say for sure three instances, there might've been a fourth that we're not thinking of. Like you said, it's a constant theme in the show.
Yeah, there were some ideas that were kind of lingering there. And I think that, you know, we'll obviously see more influences for a lot of this stuff. Yes.
Yeah, oh, so let's talk about relationships though. I'm glad you put that because that is very important moving forward.
Someone that I'd written down, and I really only kind of did it from this first season. Mike's parents, they definitely do have a very non-cohesiveness to them, as though they've kind of just settled into being married. They acknowledge each other as husband and wife, but it doesn't really seem like they have a really close relationship. I don't know.
Dad, Mike's dad just seems very disconnected. Like it's almost like that stereotypical guy that like works all day, then he comes home and then he just puts his brain on cruise control and just kind of just, right? It cruises through the evening. He's not really involved with the parenting is what it seems like. And yeah, we don't really see much going on between him and his wife. So,
and it makes you wonder what his job is. I don't know if they ever mention it, but I'm curious.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't think they do, but I could be wrong.
They probably just don't care. Like, what's the point of bringing in? It's like more information that doesn't matter, maybe.
Right.
So then we talk about Nancy and Steve. So they're in a relationship or about to be in a relationship. Mm-hmm. You know, I feel like it's very much the typical like douchebag guy. innocent girl.
And I think Nancy has usually been kind of in the quieter, nerdier crowd, right? And then Steve is in this super popular crowd. So there's a point in time, I think it's in the first episode, where Nancy and her friend Barb are talking. Nancy tells Barb, like, hey, Steve invited me to go somewhere or something like that. And and they kind of talk like, oh my gosh, if we get in with this group, like, we're going to be so cool. And Barb's all worried about Nancy hanging out with all these popular people now. And so there's a huge social distinction between those two.
At least with Barb and everyone else. Because Nancy, I don't know, it could just be too, you know, she's just matured and Steve caught a whiff of that. And then Jim Hopper with anyone, which initially anyways, is he kind of seems distanced. And we find out that his daughter had died years prior. He also ended up getting a divorce, and we find this out early. Just so emotionally draining for him, I would imagine. At this point anyways, like, it's just...
We can assume that he has problems with alcohol too, because there's multiple scenes in the first one, or I mean, even in the first episode, there might be two different scenes of him waking up after drinking all night and walking into work hungover. And
yeah,
so it seems like he just goes to work, barely gets through the day, kind of numb, then he goes home and drinks and just rinse repeat. Should we talk about Mike and Elle there then as the last relationship?
Yeah. Oh wow, I totally skipped over that one. Yeah. that was third on my list. Well, obviously gotta save the best for last. I think the idea of Elle, like, if it's not just hope in itself, you know, as of right now, I think that's what the big idea of what Elle is that she represents, like, because they kind of lose this bit of hope for finding Will. Yeah. Anyway. So I think that it's just kind of the introductory to it. And like, we can probably go more in depth as the characters interact a little bit more with her. If we're looking at it not from a theoretical and symbolic sort of perspective, obviously, like, there seems to be an interest in each other, like, as the characters themselves. Jumping into episode 2, The Weirdo on Maple Street. I don't know if they're talking about Barb.
Yeah, that's true.
I didn't think about Maple Street and which street that was.
Yeah, but there's no weirdo to me that sticks out in episode 2. I'm not sure.
Maybe it's Elle too. If Mike and them live on
Maple. Could be.
Going to the very beginning, Jim became motivated, I think indirectly, because Joyce did find out from season 1, I believe, about Hopper and his daughter and stuff. Or no, actually at this point, she doesn't even know that she's dead, because Hopper said that she lives with her mother. There wasn't anything directly about it right now. And that's why I think Joyce said that. Because otherwise, I think it'd be very... I mean, I don't know. Joyce is a very emotional individual. She could have just wanted to step over boundaries just to, you know, instigate something to get something moving. Because, you know, she's missing her son. You know, I think it's understandable why she would maybe feel the way she would. But so I don't know that she knew she crossed the line. And she probably did in some sort of way. But Jim definitely took it to heart in a positive way, which I don't think that he'd had to. Because he could have definitely snapped and then just totally disregarded Joyce for forever past that
point.
And then you jump into the flashback and they're in, you know, John's talking to Will. I think it's kind of just an instant, not needing to be a certain way because someone's telling you to be a certain way, but just being more open with how you're feeling about stuff. Hopper has a fling with a floozy.
That just kind of goes to support his like disconnection from kind of reality, just kind of going through the motions, doing whatever, you know, kind of trying to like stay numb to what's actually going on.
And I think later on, we actually find out who he's actually having a fling with. I don't know if you remember.
How far down the road is that?
Oh, it's in season 1. Yeah.
Okay.
All right. Because there's a small interaction. And I'm assuming unless this was a different situation and then could just show that Jim just, you know, he likes to get around. So, you know, we don't know, though. We don't know that. It could be one. It could be multiple. Either way, not to pass any judgment, just to kind of make instances, you know. So then Elle mentions that Will is hiding from the creature. So she has an idea. And this is where I think I'm starting to get an understanding of maybe where Elle's character and what her purpose is to kind of be the new form of understanding, hope, a belief system, where it's like she's trying to be subtle about it. But, and also, I think the idea of it, her being young, is also important as well, because it's the fact that the idea of all of this stuff is very young.
Nope. And she's like really young in season 1. Like she comes across as like an 11-year-old or something like that. Like not to be ironic.
And then it's funny, it's just the relationship that her, if she's like the new faith and the relationship she has with all these boys and then the relationship she has like with Hopper, Joyce at one point anyways, but it's still unfamiliar territory. And so I think L is then kind of just describing he's hiding from the creature. He's hiding from the honesty that he's feeling about these feelings. Like, he's just hiding from it. For right after this scene anyways, Barb cuts her hand at the party and she leaves everyone. So she's kind of away from it all. For a brief moment, I think she was trying to like fit in. She kind of embarrasses herself, I guess, in front of this group of all these cool people or whatever.
Yeah, it's because she was trying to shotgun a beer, right? And she
got a knife and then she cut herself.
I was kind of like, when I watched that scene, I was like, the way that they showed her like cutting her hand is kind of not very fun to watch. But
yeah, it makes you never want to drink beer again, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's exactly.
Totally. No, that's not what I'm saying at all. and really the only reason, going back to that, fourth point about Elle, is really the only reason that the three boys know that Will's still alive. So like right off the bat, you can kind of tell that Elle has some sort of ability to see into some sort of other dimension, if you will. You don't know that completely clearly, but you can tell there's something going on with that. Like Will is somewhere else and Elle relays that information, but nobody really knows where at this point. But the three boys find out through her that like Will's still alive. Yeah, as you know, some people start to grieve, so to speak, about, you know, the situation, and you know, they can't find Will, and the three boys, because of Elle, remain hopeful. That you can tell they're not sad at all. They're so convinced he's still there.
And it's to say, is if Elle wasn't there, if she represents hope, like if she's not there, if she's not offering the hope, do the boys actually have hope that he's still around? So I think that's definitely important for sure. We then jump ahead to Joyce. So Joyce gets a phone call. There's flashing lights that are in the house. Creature's poking through the wall. She runs out, then goes back in the house. I think it's important, again, if it's like the phone call, and if we were to really zoom into the fact that you can literally see a static shock, if you were to infer that it was a shocking news, a shocking revelation that she's coming to terms with, that Will could be gay. And then that's when we start seeing this creature poking through the walls, right? There's flashing lights, right? It's like escalating. So it goes from the shocking phone call, the flashing lights in the house, and the creature poking through the walls as being like, it's the subtle, like increase, like she's coming to realization. Okay. I think he's gay. And now I'm thinking about also in this time frame where we are in the 80s, you know, everything that might be going through a mother's head or even just a parent's head, if they're coming to a realization that their kid is about to be a sort of way that's not seen in such a positive light by the rest of society. And then she runs out of the house because she's so fearful of it. But then she reminds herself, like, this is my son. Like, this is my kid. And like, this is something that my kid is going up against right now, potentially. Then she runs back in the house because she's like, okay, I can't be afraid of this. Like, I love my son. I have to go in and go head to head kind of with this thing.
You're talking about the scene where she runs out to her car briefly, right?
Right, because she's about to get in and like, drive away. And then she looks inside the house. I don't know if it's because everything like calmed down or what it was exactly.
I don't think anything calms down. I think she just like kind of stops and thinks for a second. She's like, no, I'm going to go back inside. And then the scene cuts, right? Like as she starts walking back in.
It cuts then to Nancy and Steve. They're out at the pool and then they go upstairs. Barb is essentially saying like, you know, he only wants one thing. You know why you're going up there. And Nancy's trying to act like that's not happening. They're not about to, you know, giggity on. So Barb ends up going out to the pool by herself. She's isolated. And the lights go out again with the lights. And then creature appears. Then Barb disappears and the lights turn back on. At the same point, right, you're seeing Jonathan outside taking pictures of these moments, which I think is important just for later on. I think just for the sense of the story, where this is their way of kind of starting to get an incidence maybe of where characters are at personally. But I think this was a moment too for Barb. And I think this is where we're starting to get a general gist for what we come to understand as, you know, the world where Will ends up being and where Barb ends up being is the upside down. And this is an idea that I have. Okay. So if they call it the upside down, could it be that it's just the opposite of, so we're happy. That's a smiley face, happy. And then sad, upside down. Like, could it be that? Could it be the idea of where it's simply just, it's the difference between happiness and sadness, where for Barb, she's in this moment where she was embarrassed in front of this group of people. And then she was just abandoned by her friend for sex. And she's isolated. She's by herself. She's bleeding. Part of it, where is it, does the creature at this point, who then, you know, we find out has shown up and then Barb is gone, right? Could it just be that it's just, all right, these people are just in a dark place mentally? right? Where Barb now is just, she's just in a dark place. She's by herself. Everyone's left her. Right. You know, she's more noticeably like identified as one of the least popular kids in the school. Now she's been abandoned by maybe her only friend that she had.
Yeah. And you can also kind of see a trend where this thing, right, that's attacking these people are going after weaker people, or at least people who are in weak moments specifically.
Yeah. Mindsets.
Like, you can tell, I mean, when, you know, the whole situation with Will happens, he's freaked out. He's alone. Same thing with Barb, right?
Yeah.
He's vulnerable. He has no idea what's going on. Same thing with Barb then. She's alone. She's disappointed, in a bad state of mind. She's isolated. It's kind of dark. And you can kind of see that trend happening.
The lights turn off too, right before the creature shows up.
If I'm remembering right, isn't there right in the moment when Will disappears, the lights get really bright and intense, and then don't they just shut off, and then they come back on a second later? Back on.
Yes.
Yeah. And then he's gone.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's gone. As though like the darkness has taken the individual. And then it's not until like, oh, the lights come back up. Well, okay.
Yep.
They're gone. Oh, well. And then Jonathan's sitting there like, I guess this chick just like went away or something. I don't know.
Yeah.
In the woods, in the shielded wooded area with the camera. But yeah, I mean, that's kind of the gist, I think, of episode two anyways. Episode two. And then episode three, Holly Jolly. Barb is in a dark place. You know, the creature's after her. I think the idea of like identifying the place that she gets taken to as the dark place, I think is more of a common way of understanding where people refer to themselves if they're just not in a happy place, is they're in a dark place. And I think that's why they make it look the way that they do. What's funny is Barb is crying out for help constantly while she's there. And Nancy can kind of like, she kind of feels like she's hearing something initially, but then she's not really, and she's going back to, you know, her moment with Steve. I think that that's, you know, symbolic for probably people who, you know, in this moment when she's like telling Nancy not to go upstairs, is because she didn't want to feel alone in a moment where, you know, she was probably feeling pretty vulnerable after she cut her hand and everything. And
she already felt uncomfortable at the party the whole time. I mean, she felt out of place, not talking to anybody. She didn't even want to go to begin with. So
she didn't want to drink. She's like, Nancy, this isn't you. You don't do this. Then she tries drinking and she doesn't do well. And, you know, all of a sudden, so it's kind of like a way of just, she's crying out for help. And she, you know, this shows the show, like, she actually is, because she's in this dark place. And Nancy just wasn't there to offer the help. So Nancy gets done with Steve. She goes outside and Barb is nowhere to be found. Like, honestly, yeah. Steve got done with Nancy's
because
he was just passed out. He's like, all right. And then the boys are together. Lucas is talking about the Demogorgon isn't real, which is a way I think of them just putting a name on the creature. There's never a name from even like later on the seasons where they're actually saying that that anyone from this dark place, like the upside down, is actually naming it. Like, we're naming the creature. It's the Demogorgon. So then Justin tries to have Elle make the aluminum fly. Mike says she's not a dog.
Well, and also going back to that board game quick, for anybody watching that whole this whole board game thing, I think it is Dungeons and Dragons. I think it's a huge part of the show. Like, it comes up way down the road. Like, it's a pretty big thing. I mean, it's the kind of the cohesive nature of everybody's friendship. Not everybody's, but at least, you know, the boys, right?
Like these boys can definitely relate to each other through like playing the game, and they can refer to like situations within their adventures and stuff, and they can relate to those to real world events.
And also that aluminum falcon thing that you wrote down too, another thing I want to say about that's just another example showing, you know, that Mike is trying to defend Elle. You know, he just immediately right away, you can tell like there's something going on between these two. And then meanwhile, Dustin and Lucas are just kind of, they're still kind of questioning her, you know.
He's saying she's not a dog is like, you know, humanizer. She's not. She's not something that's like lesser than that. I think the two lights that they show immediately when they're zooming out or zooming in on her, I think that's just to kind of identify like, okay, she's to represent brightness and light and good. So Hopper and cops at the Hawkins lab, they make a comment about being a step ahead of the Russians, which we don't probably have to dig too much into that. I think that's just, they just want to reference the Russians, so you're not lost on what place and time all of this is, and society's perspective about Russia and Russians. Elle sees that Barb on pictures in Nancy's room and immediately appears worried. She saw her somehow, right? Like if we're talked about just in the storyline of it, she recognized her immediately and was like able to see like, oh, this is person who's in this dark place. Like I know I've seen her. Or if you were to just.
This also happened with Elle seeing a picture of Will. That's how all this started.
Yeah, right.
We didn't bring that up. So it's the same exact, you know, reoccurrence of the same thing, but with Barb this time, same thing.
The boys tease Mike about loving Elle, these bullies who we've identified as bullies. They show up and they make comments about, you know, Will being gay and everything like that. And I think there's a brief altercation in there. It's nothing too crazy, but this is definitely something that kind of exists with these bullies. And maybe the idea of the bullies and what their point is like, and maybe in some way it's also to say like people who do actually bully people who are gay are just bullies and they're just so childish. I think that might be kind of like the gist of what they're kind of trying to get at with that throughout the season anyways.
Well, and also afterwards during that altercation you talked about, Elle embarrasses the two bullies. Elle makes one of them pee their pants. And then, so you can see right off the bat kind of that the three boys are starting to see Elle as kind of like, they see her as like a line of defense against all sorts of things now, because, you know, she's given them hope about their missing friend, and now she's protected them from, you know, some bullies. And so you can kind of see where this is going a little bit.
Joyce hangs up the colorful Christmas lights around the house, which probably some of this is probably still a bit of a stretch or anything, but because I think it is around Christmas time, at least the end of the season, we do see that there's like a Christmas party and everything like that going on. Part of it's that, part of it could be that the idea of the rainbow lights is supposed to be sort of connected to, you know, what generally is like, you know, the LGBTQ community, the pride, you know, community and everything like that. So I wonder if part of it might be that, like, it's part of like a, she's coming to terms that it's this thing that she's still unfamiliar with, but this is the general idea of it. And like, this was the beginning part, you know, we start like, he was upset that he couldn't do the small little thing with a cat, but he got very excited when all of a sudden he, like when she was being put inside of this like little closet where she just snaps one of their necks and throws one of them against the wall, like these guards and stuff. There's an idea of like, okay, what is Papa representing maybe in this theoretical instance? So then Nancy's at home with her mom and says she thinks something's terrible happened to Barb, right? So like there's these small little quotes about things, and it's interesting, and this is what's so funny about the show of why it is. I think that there's so many metaphors, especially when we get to episode 8. There's something interesting about how they use certain context. They're very indescriptive and they're very generalized in what they're saying. So they'll say stuff like this where it's like something terrible happened to Barb. She won't go in depth. Like, I saw this creature and I think it might have taken Barb. No, you're not going to say that. Either the kids are actually that nuanced in modern conversation, they don't want to sound crazy, or the fact that because they're kids, they know that their parents might overlook what they're saying if it sounds so out of this, you know, world or anything. That was something that I took away. And then, so the ambulance is rolling by. The boys follow with Elle. There's a small child in the lake that looks dead. At this point, it looks like it's Will, and they assume that it's Will. Mike says to Elle, you were supposed to help him, you know, help find him alive. You said he was alive. Why did you lie? What's wrong with you? This is kind of like end of the episode where, to me, it was like Mike was questioning the faith that he had just happened upon, where it was like the hope that he had had. And all of a sudden, you know, he's seeing the dead body, or he thinks he's seen the dead body of his friend. All of a sudden, it's just like, what the heck? Like, you said I was supposed to be hopeful and like that we'd find this. And then all of a sudden they don't. A small interaction of doubt anyways, whether it be with the idea of hope or even just with Elle and the powers that she has. Like, what is she actually capable of?
And it'll get more clear as we go along too.
Episode 4 is called The Body. Going through a summary of that, Hopper is consoling Joyce. Says that all the crazy shit that she has seen is just grief, that Will isn't there. Joyce then gets an axe. Mike says Lucas was right about Elle. What she did was really bad. Lucas is especially his relationship with Elle, I find to be really interesting. I don't know if it's supposed to be more of a social dynamic. And I don't know if like the character of Lucas, even though that there's a you know, police officer that is black in the show, there's only really him and Lucas that are the two kind of black characters in it. So I don't know if Lucas is in some way to play like a token character, the token black character in this show, where if Elle is the representation of hope, could this kind of be, whether it be based in the 80s, whether it be based modern day, where it's, is this Lucas's relationship with hope and why he doubts it so much? And then you know, obviously Mike with the situation of finding the body, you know, is that something that's kind of translating?
Yeah, for sure. Lucas is definitely the most doubtful one about L for sure.
Because for whatever reason, like everyone else was blindly faithful or like loyal to the idea of L and what, you know, the power she had and everything. And
right.
Lucas was just more doubtful of it. There's the autopsy of Will's body, which was done by the government, which people thought was weird. Nancy was brought in to speak to the police about Barb. Nancy puts together pictures of Barb by the pool, and she sees that there was something. And we should probably say, like, in one of, I can't remember what episode it was, but at one of the episodes, Steve and his douchebag friends and Nancy find out that Jonathan had been taking pictures of them. They find this out and they broke his camera. In the process, Steve then rips up all the pictures. Well, before they leave, Nancy, she sticks around and picks up the pieces, but she actually pictures up all the pieces to this one specific picture, which I thought was funny. Like, okay, yeah. So you're picking all these pieces. You just happen to pick up all these pieces. Sees that there's a creature in it. And this becomes the first inference that Nancy has that there is something there. And like, this is her actually seeing an actual photo of it rather than what she saw outside of the house when she had gone back to just look around. So Joyce sees Will in the wall. And this is the quote that he says, "It looks like home, but it's dark, it's empty, it's cold." And if you were to put an idea to that, it's kind of like, so it is that sort of feeling like that he is in his own home, but that he just doesn't feel like his own home because he doesn't feel like he's at home. Mentally, he's in a dark place outside of the storyline. You know, there's nobody there to really caress him. It's just these dark creatures and like this thing that either he's resisting or that is there, whatever this creature is still kind of identifying at this point. Nancy then speaks to Jonathan about the picture and they see it's a creature and it looks like the one that Joyce saw. And then the quote that they had said about the creature was that it like it doesn't have a face. And that's when they realized for Jonathan, it was that his mom, Joyce, kept saying that it didn't have a face or anything like that. And then Nancy was the one who was the one that she recognized that it didn't have a face either. And it wasn't until Jonathan had heard it now from two different places where he's like, oh shit, like this might be an actual thing. And so then Hopper finds out that there is something different about the body. We find that he had gone to this morgue or wherever it was. He had gotten past this security guard by beating his ass. And then he got inside and he pulled out the body and he cut it open. We find that it's just full of like cotton or something. Like it's just completely fake.
Hopper situation, finding that body or going to look at the body. There was an interesting conversation that happened right prior to that where Hopper goes into a bar and he's talking to the person, the officer that found Will's body. I don't remember exactly what was said between the two, but Hopper knew something was up. Hopper knew that this officer was lying about something and some sort of altercation happens. They go outside and you know, Hopper is beating him up behind the bar, trying to get information from him.
Yeah.
And then they both turn around and there's a unmarked, presumably government car sitting there watching them. And then the person that Hopper's beating up, "You're going to get both of us killed." And then he runs away and then the car drives away and Hopper tries to chase after him with the gun. So now at this point, this whole government conspiracy deal is starting to build up, becoming more obvious that like probably the federal government is involved with this or trying. Obviously at this point, you know, they're trying to cover up the death, but we don't know why. We have no idea what's going on. So things are kind of building up with that.
I don't know that there's too much from this specific scene, but it definitely is one of those things where, you know, no matter what's going on, it's as though if you were to still inference that the government and or that the whatever this agency is like monitoring over everybody is similar to kind of just like old traditional faith. It's just it's always lingering and it's always kind of there and it's always like in people's lives. You can talk about all this new stuff as much as you want to. It's always going to be there to kind of protect the traditional values that have kind of existed.
There's also consistent cutscenes throughout all of these episodes that show this group of people in some sort of room listening into random conversations around Hawkins. Yes. So, you know, they're listening in, you know, they have some sort of vested interest into figuring out whether or not the citizens in the area are catching on to something going on.
Right.
So in my opinion, season four is kind of where shit hits the fan, where like you start to actually kind of realize where this is going a little bit. You know, Hopper really starts to catch on to the situation. He kind of starts to take matters into his own hands. He's breaking into buildings. He's sneaking into places. He's finding out that there's a bunch of cover-ups. And So season four, I think season four is probably either the most important or second most important episode out of the whole season one.
We're definitely starting to kind of get a gist of more motivational aspects of each side, the groups and everything. We're understanding exactly like what intentions definitely exist with each one of them. And that's, you know, definitely a good point. You know, whether it's that they're monitoring to make sure that the status quo is being met in with certain people and like with these wires, we're presuming are kind of existing, because otherwise, how are these people listening into everything? Thanks again for tuning into Stranger Conversations, a new series on Michelanias. Stay tuned for episode 2, where Jared and I discuss season 1, episodes 5-8. Until then, we'll see you later. If you like this episode, don't forget you can share it on your social media platforms like Facebook or Twitter. It will definitely help us to be able to reach a broader audience so more people like you can enjoy. We appreciate all the help you give us.